Remember those white casserole dishes with the little blue flowers? How about the Pyrex pie plates your grandmother swore by? They were made by Corning Glass. And these days, Corning's gone way beyond cookware, into specialty materials from catalytic converter substrates to fiber optic cable. All this from a small glassworks that made industrial history when it found a way to mass-produce light bulbs. Meg Graham chronicles the company's remarkable 150-year history in her book Corning and the Craft of Innovation. She told Anne Strainchamps that Corning's quest for innovation has taken it in many directions.
Pyrex was a very important product to that company, and in fact, so important that they almost considered changing the name of the company to Pyrex. But much earlier than Pyrex, they did tubing for thermometers, they did glass for light bulbs, they were a major factor in glass for vacuum tubes, for radio, for CRTs, for cathode ray tubes, for television.
What does Corning make today?
It continues to be in a number of different industries. I mean, one of its major businesses, for instance, is in substrates for catalytic converters. It makes the ceramic substrates, which is a very demanding product. And another major area they have is in substrates for biological testing.
Corning's management decided early on to commit the company to something they have over the years called the uncluttered path. What does that mean?
Well, to them, I think it meant a course of action based on technology that was not inhabited by some other significant company that they could have to themselves. And if they could push that technology far enough, fast enough, deep enough, that they could reap the rewards for that without having to compete with other major companies that were far larger than they were. So that means that growth is a problem. Because unlike so many other companies that just assume that growth is a good thing, a company that worries about control has to worry about losing control if they grow too fast or too much. For Corning, the uncluttered path was the path that would allow them to make the best use of their technologies, the most profitable use of their technologies, without having to compete head-on with much larger companies.
But that must mean that in practical terms, they've wound up trying to stake out areas that were highly experimental or that people hadn't even gone into. I mean, it must have meant taking risks all the time.
Always. This company is phenomenal for the risk they've managed to take. If you look at the fiber optic story, for instance, it blows me away.
Wait, explain the fiber optic story. Will you sort of set the stage and how Corning got involved in this?
Well, Corning became aware that there was going to be a need for a replacement for copper cable sometime down the road. And there was theory to suggest that glass fiber might be a suitable replacement with obvious, much, much greater capacity than copper had. So Corning went into that business thinking, well, we have more expertise than almost anybody, in fact, than anybody in this form of glass. And it's conceivable that we might be able to develop something here that's better than anyone else can do. So here's the uncluttered path as a potential. But they weren't just going out and risking a lot of money on a whim.
No, but still, I mean, this is a time when the rest of corporate America is streamlining and downsizing. And Corning decides to pour enormous amounts of company resources into a product that nobody even wants yet.
Well, I think that's substantially true. And not only that, it was a time when Corning was downsizing. But the family had always been determined that in order to innovate, in order to keep the company, in order to keep control of the company, in order to keep it moving forward, they had to have some new product. And they always liked to look for things that had potentially major impact. And this was one of them.
So how did it play out? What's the end of the story?
Well, first of all, it has to be said that it was somewhere around 16 to 17 years before Corning made any money on its investment. That's a length of time that very few companies would be willing to keep something alive. But what happened, and here I suppose you could say they were very lucky, but this is a case of chance favoring the prepared mind, they were ready with a second generation of fiber optics at a time when the American telephone industry was breaking up. And MCI and some of the Baby Bells saw the opportunity to use fiber for long-distance communications as a way of differentiating themselves and getting ahead. So Corning was at the right place at the right time with fiber. The distinction that's always important to make is the difference between invention, which often is an accident, and innovation, which involves the activities of many, many different kinds of people, has to.
But so, practically, what does that mean in how you run a company and how managers talk to employees and how employees are treated?
I think, for instance, that it means balancing off things that other companies may take for granted, like productivity, the drive for productivity, the drive for efficiency, the drive for quality. All of those things are extremely important disciplines, but they can't be driven so hard that they counteract some of the things that are important to innovation. For instance, innovation requires a certain amount of redundancy. You can't squeeze out every extra minute that people have to think, or you can't squeeze out every research project that may not be right on task at the moment. You have to allow a certain amount of freedom for people to exercise their own ingenuity.
Are you saying that as a company, they've been more tolerant than many other companies would have been of the eccentric individual?
Definitely. In fact, their stories, and you can always tell a company by its stories. One of my favorites is a man named Jim Giffen, who was a very talented machine designer and quite an irascible man, quite difficult to deal with. And each new CEO that came in was told, you've got to do whatever it is that's important right now, and you also have to take care of Jim Giffen, defend him. And this went to some extreme lengths. For instance, Jim Giffen decided at one point that he really preferred to live in Florida. And he wanted to go down there and hunt and fish, and he just was sick of working in upstate New York. And so they called him into the office and they said, Jim, why are you unhappy? And he said, oh, I really want to get down to Florida more often. And they said, how often do you want to go? And he said, oh, I'd sort of like to go at least 6 times a year. And they said, well, what'll that cost you, you and your wife, to go? And they made it possible for him to go 6 times a year. But then they said, what'll happen if we really absolutely need you up here? What should we do? And they decided the thing they needed to do was to ship his whole crew down to Florida to be with him.
You're kidding.
And that's what they did.
Isn't Jim Giffen the guy, the machine inventor, who... Yes.
One of Jim Giffen's key characteristics was that he was very contemptuous of people with advanced degrees. And that included even people with undergraduate degrees, but he particularly disliked people with PhDs. And, of course, he was surrounded by them because he worked very closely in and around the R&D organization. But in one case, there was a man named Howard Lilly, who was a famous physicist who was particularly interested in flow mechanics. And Howard Lilly had demonstrated that the method that Jim Giffen had invented for producing cathode ray tube casings, spinning them, that method could not be adapted when television tubes changed from circles to rectangles. So Jim Giffen looked at Howard Lilly's proof that this simply could not be done, that you could not cast CRT tubes in the old way, and went home and that night devised a way to do this so that you could, in fact, cast them in a rectangle, and came back. And I'm convinced that what motivated him to do that was to show up Howard Lilly. I mean, he did it within 24 hours.
Meg Graham teaches management at McGill University in Montreal and is one of the founders of the Winthrop Group, a management consulting firm. Her book is Corning and the Craft of Innovation. Anne Strainchamps talked with her at her summer home in Maine.